B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, March 7th, 2017. The orange monster in the White House promised that health care reform under his watch would be beautiful and would make us very happy. That's just more bullshit from Trump. It sucks. It sucks real bad. And the simple way to describe this rewrite of healthcare is that it will cut funding for poor people and it will cut taxes for rich people. And it is a shift of wealth to the wealthy at the expense of the poor and the lower middle class. And while I have had many criticisms of Obamacare, the way it thrust millions of new customers into the greedy arms of for-profit healthcare insurance companies? Well, it did, in fact, expand coverage. And many people will lose coverage over the next 3 to 4 years if this plan is implemented. Now, the Republicans are hoping to ram this through in days. They claim that they can pass it this week. And we'll get to the mechanics of that in a moment. But on the face of it, what this does is rejigger some of the formulas from Obamacare. It sharply reduces the amount of money available for Medicaid for the poor across the entire nation, and it leaves the poor people at the mercy of state governments. And we know that there are far more red states than blue states right now. So this is a recipe for poor people to die. If you can't afford to go to a doctor and buy good health insurance, you're on your own, buddy. That's the great American free market way of life and death. And one of the things that I'm able to see here is that apparently through the transition they're proposing, I will be able to keep my Obamacare coverage until I become eligible for Medicare. But many people who are under the age of 60 are not so fortunate. And if this plan passes as it is currently devised, for example, the premium support, the subsidies for people, are offered without a means test. Means that if you're 60 years old, you're entitled to $4,000 in a subsidy from the federal government in the form of a refundable tax credit. And that means that each month you have to pay the full freight for your health insurance bill, and then next April 15th, you can recover it in a refund. Now, currently, Obamacare provides monthly subsidies so that the individuals who qualify only have to pay the net amount due. And it is written as a tax credit, but it is spent. They give the money to the health insurance companies each month as the individual pays his or her premium. Not only will that change, but on Medicaid, which has expanded coverage to more than 10 million people in 31 states, they will scrap the requirement that people have insurance, and it will eliminate tax penalties for those who go without. But by turning it into a block grant, allowing the states to determine how that money is spent, allowing insurance to be sold across state lines where you're going to have various standards, some much lower. And the Republicans figure they can paper this over with low-deductible, catastrophic policies. And I have to restate that. I think they will be high-deductible, but they're going to pretend that these are affordable because the premiums for high-deductibles are lower. Now, one of the poison pills in the bill would cut off all federal funds to Planned Parenthood clinics through Medicaid and other government programs for 1 year. And in a moment, I'll explain how the Donald hopes to be the white knight in this case, but I think that it is just more posturing. So this is a very ugly package. And what's interesting is that there are the United States Senate is where the action is going to finally play out. Because the House, there are certainly people on the Republican side who will decide not to support this Republican bill. But it's in the Senate where the real friction will surface. So we have four senators, Rob Portman of Ohio, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, Cory Gardner of Colorado, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. They've signed a letter saying that this draft does not adequately protect people in states like theirs that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. So you have four Republicans who are potential defectors from the current proposal because of what it does. And then we have three senators, and I identified them last week, Mike, Rand, and Ted. That's Mike Lee of Utah, Rand Paul of Kentucky, Ted Cruz of Texas. They're saying that they won't support an Obamacare light. They want full repeal. And they don't seem to care what the consequences are, either politically, short term, or in human terms, in long range, in a long range focus. So this is going to be a real train wreck. And Republicans feel that their base will support them through thick and thin. But many people in that Republican base have benefited directly or indirectly from Obamacare. And what remains to be seen is how important that is to them at the next elections. Now, one of the most egregious problems with this package, putting aside all of its onerous elements, is that the Republicans, and this appears to be intentional, have set up a timeline that does not permit independent analysis of the bill. That is called scoring, and we have the Congressional Budget Office that's supposed to be independent, and it scores these bills for their true cost and impact. And at this point, we have no idea what the true cost of the Republican package will be, and we have no idea exactly how many people will lose coverage as a result of this so-called reform. And one of the real stinky elements here is that one of the compromises to pass Obamacare and to get it adequately funded was a tax on the CEOs of healthcare and health insurance companies. And it took away the deduction for salaries over $500,000 a year. And you might be surprised to learn that this generated $72 million a year in additional tax revenue. We've got a lot of overpaid healthcare CEOs out there. And that is eviscerated. It is removed from the new Republican proposal. And one guy who's described as an expert, I don't know Lauren Adler, but he is a healthcare expert linked to Brookings Institute. And he said, reading through the bill, it's hard to imagine the coverage loss is any less than 15 million Americans. Yeah, that's beautiful, isn't it, Donald? That's going to make 15 million people very happy. Now, I mentioned the Faustian bargain that is being advanced by Donald Trump, apparently on the urging of his daughter, Ivanka. And that is, he is offering to prevent the Congress from cutting the funds for Planned Parenthood for an entire year by saying, I'll be the good cop here. I'll be the white knight. And if you will agree to eliminate all abortion services from Planned Parenthood across the country, then I will find a way to make sure that your funding remains in place. And, you know, Donald thinks that everything can be reduced to a deal, a trade-off. But to its credit, the leaders of Planned Parenthood will not engage in this kind of a Hobson's choice. Dawn Lagoons, the executive vice president of Planned Parenthood Federation, let's be clear, federal funds already do not pay for abortions. Offering money to Planned Parenthood to abandon our patients and our values is not a deal we will ever accept. Providing critical health care services for millions of American women is non-negotiable. Now, I hope they maintain that posture. But this is the kind of ugly and immoral, amoral thinking that passes for rational thought in our occupied capital today. Today's Tuesday, tomorrow's Wednesday, March 8th. It's International Women's Day, and as we've been mentioning, women across the nation are planning to go on strike, to stage rallies. People who don't protest are planning to wear red in solidarity. If you feel that you might lose your job if you go on strike tomorrow, that might be the wiser route to take. And it'll be very interesting to see how this day and the events that are planned play out, what kind of media coverage they get. And with that in mind, today I'm releasing a new in-depth interview. It is a round table with three very interesting and smart people who have new books out about protest and activism. They include L.A. Kaufman, whose new book, Direct Action, is a history of modern America protest and radicalism. We also included Sarah Van Gelder from Yes Magazine, and her new book is called The Revolution Where You Live. She clocked 12,000 miles crossing the country to talk to people who are activists in their own communities. And our third participant, Tom Attlee, has published a book recently called Empowering Public Wisdom. And he has some very interesting ideas, visionary ideas, for how we can take control of our own communities and work it from there. In our roundtable conversation, we had some very interesting exchanges, and here's a brief one for your listening pleasure.
Large mass mobilizations rarely work as pressure tactics per se. They work as movement-building mechanisms. And the Women's March accomplished a number of things. One which I think was absolutely essential, and it's almost hard to think back before that day, is that it broke a spell of fear. People in the period between the election and Inauguration Day, the fear that I saw and the reluctance, people were maybe making phone calls, but they were the protests that happened were small, and they were the hardcore who come out no matter what. And in terms of breaking that paralysis and emboldening people to act, it was extraordinary. And it's opening up all kinds of new possibilities. I mean, this women's strike tomorrow is not going to be on the same scale as the Women's March, and people who are expecting that there's going to be, you know, millions staying home will be disappointed. It's not going to look like that. But it is, I think, a very interesting attempt to flex a muscle that we haven't been using much. We haven't used tactics of mass noncompliance very often in the United States. The model that they're building on is the day without an immigrant, which has been the most interesting recent example of one of these sectoral strikes. But it's also part of a longer-term movement-building strategy by the organizers, which included, first off, the very powerful platform that they put together for the Women's March on the 21st, which is a much more synthetic version of feminism than we've seen. It's a quite powerful statement worth looking at. But they followed that up. What happened in between the Women's March and the event that's going to happen tomorrow that very few people saw was they organized these small local group gatherings, which they called huddles, mm-hmm. and encouraged people who had participated in the march to meet with others in their community, talk about what issues concern them, and begin developing both a group and an action plan. And they had more than 5,000 of those huddles mm-hmm. around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So they are precisely looking at some of these small group forms that both Sarah and Tom have been talking about these ways of getting together and imagining a different world, imagining a different kind of collective process.
I hope you'll listen to the full roundtable conversation with Tom Attlee, Sarah Van Gelder, and L.A. Kaufman. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, all of the major platforms that we distribute on, and it is available for the first 14 days to subscribers. So That's the benefit you get for supporting my work. And belated thanks to Mitchell Kaddish, who kicked in some money back in September, and I dropped the ball. We just got his subscription set up in the last day or so. And Mitchell is a loyal listener who kicked in more than he had to. Thank you, Mitchell. I really appreciate that. And let's not forget the folks at DGL, Andy Krieger, Bill Goodacre, and Tracy Williams, all supporters of the Peter B. Collins podcast. I invite you to join them. Just come over to my website. It's peterbcollins.com. Click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and all the details are right there. Well, WikiLeaks has done it again. They have come into possession of 7,800 pages of secret CIA documents, which it is calling Vault 7. And Vault 7 includes some really tantalizing hacking and surveillance tools, like systems that allow them to bypass encryption on phone and messaging services, including Signal, WhatsApp, and Telegram, which we are told are sufficiently encrypted to protect our privacy. In addition, it reveals something that we've been teased about for the last 3 or 4 years, and that is our spooks can penetrate Android phones, collect audio and message traffic before the encryption is applied. They can activate your smart TV and eavesdrop on conversations in the room where your TV happens to be located, your bedroom, your family room, living room, media room, if you're that rich. Now, the documents come from the CIA Center for Cyber Intelligence, are dated from 2013 to 2016. WikiLeaks calls them the largest ever publication of confidential documents on the agency, and a former CIA intelligence officer has at least made a preliminary evaluation that the documents are genuine. And in a change of pace, WikiLeaks did redact names and other identifying information from the collection and said that they're not going to release the thousands hundred million lines of computer code, several hundred million lines. They're going to hold on to that because the person who gave this to WikiLeaks, an unnamed source, issued a statement saying that she or he wants to spark a debate about policy questions that urgently need to be debated in public, including whether the CIA's hacking capabilities exceed its mandated powers and the problem of public oversight of the agency. And the source wishes to initiate this public debate about the security creation, use, proliferation, and democratic control of cyber weapons. So this is another fascinating leak. Nobody so far has said that the Russians have any fingerprints on this one. One of the programs exposed is called Umbridge, a voluminous library of cyber attack techniques the CIA has collected from malware produced by other countries, including Russia. So we'll look forward to more coverage of that in the coming days. Meanwhile, and I know this is going to be really disappointing to Rachel Maddow, because on a nightly basis, and I watch her show every night, she's been spinning this Russian-based spy thriller, and one of the angles of intrigue is the continued repeated question, where is Christopher Steele? Christopher Steele has dropped out of sight. Christopher Steele, the man who wrote the dodgy dossier about the golden showers in Moscow, he can't be found. And she's made it seem like he was snuffed out or given a polonium cocktail by Putin or something like that. Well, Christopher Steele showed up for work today in London and said he will have no further comment about the dossier that he wrote. But he wanted to thank all the nice people who sent him kind messages and support over the last few weeks. He didn't name Rachel. There's another British figure who enters into the current scandal that was launched by Twitter by Trump last Saturday, the claim that Obama ordered wiretaps on Trump Tower before the election. Well, this is an interesting woman named Louise Mensch, and the Washington Post wrote her up today. She's a former member of parliament in Britain. She served a single term there, and she got some notoriety because she was involved in the investigation of the tabloid phone hacking scandal among the British newspapers. The Washington Post chose to bury at the very last line of this article. She now works as an executive for News Corp, a media company owned by Rupert Murdoch. Now, one of the Murdoch properties is called Heat Street, and Louise Mensch wrote a piece for Heat Street, and she is seen as a credible source for the claim that the American Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court, issued a warrant, and she says she never claimed that it was about wiretapping. Her headline at the Heat, or at Heat Street, read, "Exclusive, FBI granted FISA warrant covering Trump camp's ties to Russia." Now, the nature of that warrant is given no further detail. But Louise Mensch describes herself as not a Trump supporter, that she is a strong nationalist and a supporter of spooks and the spy community, and that her reporting does not back up Trump's wiretapping claim. It simply refers to a warrant and doesn't mention anything about wiretapping. Nevertheless, Heat Street is one of the many sources that the White House has cited in justifying the unproven claims of Trump in his Twitter shitstorm last Saturday. Pardon my language. Now, it's also interesting to some of my listeners that Louise Mensch is married to Peter Mensch, who is the, outsized manager of Metallica and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And while I've never met Peter Mensch, 15 years ago, I was renting an office in a space here in Marin County, California, and Metallica bought the building and paid us to vacate. That's about my only connection to Metallica. And one more tidbit here about the Russia claims. Over at Think Progress, that's the blog run by the Center for American Progress, run by John Podesta, so you know where those loyalties lie. And Jed Legum, who I've known for 10 years or so, he wrote this piece saying that despite the denials, Trump did meet with the Russian ambassador Vislyak last April. And in fact, he met him just as he was about to give a major foreign policy address. And a few minutes before he made those remarks, Trump met at a VIP reception with Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. And he warmly greeted Kislyak and three other foreign ambassadors who came to the reception. So he's got the same amnesia that Jeff Sessions and Mike Flynn had. I don't know if this will become actionable or not. Trump tweeted out another lie early today based on a news account that he received that a former Guantanamo prisoner, whose name was Yasir al-Silmi, was killed by a U.S. airstrike in Yemen. The inference here is that he had returned to the battlefield, but I have no idea what Silmi was doing in Yemen. Maybe he was a combatant, maybe he wasn't. But that's what we are supposed to infer from this. And so Trump then blasted out an alternate fact-filled tweet, blaming Obama for, quote, 122 vicious prisoners freed from Guantanamo Bay who had returned to the battlefield. But in actuality, even using the loosey-goosey standards that the Pentagon uses to define a return to the battlefield, only 9 of the individuals released from Gitmo by Obama have, quote-unquote, re-engaged in terrorism. The vast majority, the other 113, were released under George W. Bush. And so Trump was off by a factor of, 9 into 122? Roughly 10. That's the best math I can do in my head. And the actual numbers are that 21% of former inmates released by Bush are believed to have returned to the so-called battlefield, while under 6% of Obama's releases fit that description. China is very concerned, and this gets a little complicated. I believe that the U.S. is overreacting to the recent events in North Korea, and that by giving Kim Jong-il, or Kim Jong-un, any attention, you only egg him on to further rattle the cages of the West. So, with that said, the U.S. has delivered a new missile defense system It just arrived in South Korea yesterday, and it's called THAAD. I've never heard of THAAD, THAAD. And the Chinese are so upset because they believe that this upsets the balance of terror or power in that region. Now, the U.S. is doing this to counter another set. There were four missiles launched from North Korea yesterday. And South Korea, of course, is in the middle of turmoil as its female president, Park, is being prosecuted for impeachment. And there are further allegations of bribery and other tawdry efforts that have benefited her since she took office. So this becomes a complicated picture where South Korea is leaderless, North Korea is aggressive, the Chinese are objecting to the U.S. Trying to back up South Korea, and all of this could turn into a hot conflict with a mistake. Who makes the mistake? Well, one of the things that I raise is that we know that North Korea has improved its missile technology, and while it doesn't have very good aim, it can get greater distances than it did in the past. And we believe that they have detonated crude nuclear weapons. What we don't know, and there's no proof of this either way, is have they fashioned a nuclear warhead that can actually work with one of these missiles they've developed and deliver a nuclear payload to a target? I'm very doubtful of that. And one of the things that prevents the United States from just a preemptive bombing raid on North Korea is that North Korea has craftily put its missile launchers on mobile platforms. So on any given day, we don't know where they all are. More news on Trump's travel ban announced the rewrite was issued yesterday. And as I mentioned, I think that enough lawyers were involved in the redrafted royal decree that it may, in fact, pass muster with the federal courts. I hope not, but I think it might. And one of the other concerns that I didn't express yesterday is that the new structure is a 90-day ban on travelers and a 120-day ban on anyone coming in from Syria. And I believe that these are just initial programs that are likely to be extended over and over again once they are put in place. That's speculation on my part, but I believe it. That's why I'm saying it. Meanwhile, the efforts by Trump to crack down on undocumented persons and limit new immigration to the United States has produced a bit of a land rush on an American border. That's right. People are streaming to the border. They get close and then they take a taxi to the border and then they walk over that border. And up to this point, I'm sure that everything that I'm saying caused you to imagine that I'm talking about the southern border. No, I'm not. I'm talking about upstate New York and upstate Vermont. And my ancestors came from Vermont. I've spent a fair amount of time up there. And the New York Times profiles a cab driver from Plattsburgh, New York, named Chris Crowningshield. And he notes that recently, riders have been asking him, sometimes as many seven times a day, to take them to the end of Roxham Road. And at the end of Roxham Road, it says the road is closed, there are some boulders. But if you persevere, the other side of those boulders, you're in Canada. And the Canadians are very gracious about extending potential asylum. Most of the people who cross over are greeted by a Mountie who drives them to the nearest immigration station, and many of them are given a bus ticket to Montreal, where they wait for a hearing on their refugee status. We often talk here about the deep state, about the government that has full continuity no matter who the president is, no matter who's running the Congress. And I was amused by a piece published in today's New York Times with a series of establishment denials that, oh, yeah, Turkey's got a deep state. Pakistan, yeah, they got a deep state. Egypt, oh, yeah, they've had a deep state for a long time, but not the U.S. of A. We don't got no deep state here. Now, to be fair, neither Trump nor his brain, Steve Bannon, has publicly used the term deep state. But Here's the way Newt Gingrich describes it. President Trump is discovering he has a huge, huge problem underneath him. I think he's shocked that the system is as hostile as it is. We're up against a permanent bureaucratic structure defending itself and quite willing to break the law to do so. And that is the definition of deep state. But Mike Hayden, the cue ball who used to run the NSA and was a CIA director under Bush, he said, deep state? Oh, I'd never use that. That's a phrase for Turkey and other countries, but not the American Republic. And here's a former top official in Obama's National Security Council, Lauren Shulman. And she said, a deep state, when you're talking about Turkey or Egypt or other countries, that's part of a government or people outside of government that are literally controlling the direction of the country no matter who's actually in charge, and probably engaging in murder and other corrupt practices. It's shocking to hear that kind of thinking from a president or the people closest to him. It's rich. It's really rich. Hey, I'm surprised by this. The Trump administration has explicitly warned Israel against annexing parts of the occupied West Bank, saying it would trigger an immediate crisis between the two close allies. I am very surprised to hear this coming from the Trump administration, which has pledged total love and submission to the Zionist government in Israel. Well, we'll see how all of this goes. Avigdor Lieberman, the knuckle-dragging defense minister in the Netanyahu cabinet, is on his way to Washington for working meetings. And here's another surprise. Dianne Feinstein, my senator from here in California, she ran an op-ed in today's Chronicle here in San Francisco opposing the confirmation of David Friedman, Trump's bankruptcy lawyer, as the U.S. ambassador to Israel. Now, I don't know if she will prevail, but as a Jewish American who has been stoutly supportive of Israel, having Dianne Feinstein say this is pretty substantial. She says Friedman's positions are so extreme that he tried to walk them back at his confirmation hearing. But pandering for votes doesn't negate a lifetime of radical views. If confirmed, I seriously doubt he would push for a two-state solution after so forcefully denouncing it in the past. Even more frightening, she closes, I feel his confirmation would only fan the flames of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Friedman's comments questioning the legitimacy of the Palestinian leadership make it impossible for him to be a neutral arbiter for peace. Feinstein is also demanding a special counsel in the Russiagate saga, whatever we want to call this. And this occurs against the backdrop of a written statement submitted by Jeff Sessions, to the Judiciary Committee on Monday, saying that he didn't commit perjury, that he didn't understand Al Franken's question. And this produced some shouting inside the committee, as Al Franken said that Sessions' comments were insulting and demanded that the so-called attorney general be called back before the panel. Chairman Chuck Grassley, raising his voice, accused Franken of having asked Sessions a gotcha question, and the two shouted over each other. So I don't know that the Democrats have enough juice to get an independent counsel of any true independence, but we shall see. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. It's available every day on YouTube, and I hope you'll share it with friends and family and let more people know that it's out here. I always welcome your comments and feedback. Use my personal email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.